gaggle of geese. More fun than a room full of wombats. Able to reach huge audiences with a single broadcast. Yes, it's the Outdoor Journal Radio Show. And now, another exciting episode in the adventures of Outdoor Journal Radio.
Yeah, boy. In commemoration of our guest today.
You're talking up that accent
boy,
there.
You betcha.
I got you, Southern drawl and all.
Welcome to the program, Outdoor Journal Radio, the podcast. I'm Angelo Biola. He is Peter Bowman. We have Volvo. We have Nick. We have Dean. Everybody. The whole gang is here. And why would they not be? This is a very special episode. For me, personally. I don't know how you guys feel about it.
Oh, yeah, buddy.
But I've been doing this nonsense for a long time, and I got to tell you, I'm feeling it. I'm feeling, you know, call it excitement, call it nerves. I don't know what it is, but I'm feeling it. Joining us very quickly, we're not going to ramble on very long, is a gentleman who we have idolized, those of us in the television fishing business, probably since the beginning of our careers. His name is Bill Dance.
For those. Give me a hell yeah.
Yeah, baby.
Yes,
you betcha.
Sir,
they were generous enough with their time to give us today for him to come on the show. Bill is very busy. He is
a busy man.
My God, you, at ICAST, I never get him.
I flock around him like he's an absolute rock star.
They're just pulling him for interviews.
He is an absolute rock star.
He is a rock star. He's the rock star of our business.
Yeah. Yes.
No doubt about it. Anyways, he's going to be here on Outdoor Journal Radio, the podcast. I'm so excited.
Yes, sir. I hear you.
All right. Enough of that nonsense.
Yes.
What else do we have here? Well, let's talk about the usual stuff because we need to do that because we need to pay bills, folks.
Come on now.
We do it because we pay bills with this stuff.
Madame Tangay would make us. She makes us do this first Fishing
Madame
Canada's
Tangay does it.
Yes, right. She makes us do this every week.
Big sale going on at shop.fishingcanada.com for those of you who may not be familiar with
it. It's the fall sale now.
Hey.
The fall sale now, finally.
Hey.
Hey, I like that. Finally, the fall sale. The old Oshawa dinner jacket there.
That's right.
Yeah.
By the way,
like
there's
that.
A bunch of new stuff. I had a privilege of looking at some of the new stuff that's going in there in the days
you
and weeks
You keep saying
to come.
This, and you're never spilling any hints to us.
You'll love it.
Or anything like
it's
that.
It's going to be exciting.
Okay.
All I can say is keep an eye out on it. It's all happening at shop.fishingcanada.com, or you can go to fishingcanada.com, go through the front door instead of the back door. Sometimes, you know, either or will work. But if you go through the front door, you'll also be able to check out some of the other wonderful features there. Not only is it the gateway, the portal to your next fishing adventure, but it just contains so much good entertainment and wonderful information there that you can just spend hours, days, weeks, months. You know.
Did you ever notice when you owned Barclays, who came in more, which customers came in more, the side door or the front door?
Well, John Labatt used to come down through the roof. I remember him. You remember Johnny?
Oh, how could I forget Johnny?
God love him. I hope he's listening.
God.
Love John. John Labatt was one of my top 10 favorite customers at the
store. I knew John Labatt before I knew John Labatt, though.
Yes, you did, because you worked with him, right?
I knew his dad.
You knew his dad?
His dad through my dad. And the junior. He's a junior. Your Johnny Labatt's a junior. So there you go.
What a character.
Imagine him being a junior.
Oh, my God.
That's what we should have called him, Junior.
I didn't know. If you had told me, I would have.
I told you a long time ago.
Oh, I don't know what you told me a long time ago. I don't know what you told me this morning.
True. True that.
You know?
True that, John Labatt.
We put last week, we kind of talked about a delicate subject around the camp here.
Well, we had a question, a comment.
We had a comment about language and boundaries and whatnot. So we reached out to you and said, hey, let us know what you think. Now, we got like, it was, would that be the quickest response we've ever had, Dean, to anything on the show?
Yeah, it might be actually. Like
within hours of putting the show out there.
Yep.
We got our first bunch of responses.
Yeah, because we got a poll that's going to go up on fishingcanada.com or on Spotify.
On Spotify.
Right.
It's going to go on.
When is that going?
It went up when the episode did. But people, so the episode went up at 5 a.m.
Yep.
I get up just after that.
Yeah.
Poll, and before I could put the poll up, we had comments elsewhere.
Yeah, see, so they're beating the
people beat me.
See, now, if it wasn't for the fact that this is a delicate issue, I would have had some comedy to add to your comment.
Okay.
But I'm not going to.
Okay.
Oh, right. Wow. Well, there you go.
Think about it. Come on, help me with that.
You've lost me.
He gets up at 5:30 before he put the poll up at 5:30.
The poll up?
Oh, I get it.
5:30? Now I'm getting it.
Anyways.
Now you have to get up earlier, Dean, when you're doing this kind of stuff.
So. Oh, my God. Anyways, so we have the first, and now I noticed you got, yeah, there it is there. Okay. I was going to say, is it in here? I thought I saw it. So we got the very first one that we've pulled. Now, I don't want folks to think that all we're going to put up here are the pro, yeah, hell yeah, let the boys loose kind of thing.
We haven't had any negative ones that I've seen yet.
But you will promise me that we will, in the weeks to come, if there are negative comments, we will put them up.
Well, this was spawned from a negative comment.
Yeah.
This is all because of a negative comment. Right. So, you know, Dean's not hiding that stuff from us. Nope. So.
All right.
And it was about censorship. It's about the question that came up. Do we need to be really swearing on this podcast? The guy had a kid or two that was listening in the car, and he'd rather not have us, you know, popping our little swear words in here and there.
So, and I think I said this last week, and I will reiterate again today. I don't think we should go out of our way to.
No.
I think if it's in general conversations that you and I might have on the boat, I think it would be okay, but I don't think we need to fact. It's, you know, it's like the goons that are fighting in hockey, right? I love a good hockey fight, but I do not like a staged hockey fight. In other words, where they go out of their way before the puck even drops, you can see the two goons already talking, saying, okay, as soon as the puck drops, you go over there, I'll punch you over there. I don't like that. Right. And I think this is very similar to that. If our language...
If it's organic
in nature. Thank you.
There you go.
I appreciate that.
You're quite well.
Anyways.
Versus orgasmic. Because then you get the censorship going there.
Exactly.
Right?
You don't want to do that.
You don't want to censor that kind
of
stuff.
So from Danimal Outdoors, our very first comment on the subject. Danimal, that's quite the name.
I like that, Danimal.
Danimal. So maybe his name's Dan and he's an animal.
Or animal. He's the animal of the group.
Maybe. Anyways, the Danimal Outdoor says, I have a 10 and 7-year-old and genuinely have no concerns with cussing. I'm certain they hear more day-to-day from strangers. And in my opinion, part of life is learning when to use professional words and when swearing isn't acceptable.
Very good.
I would personally find the show less authentic censorship. My kids love to listen to the show. They've also enjoyed D-O-L-O, Diaries of a Lodge Owner, who's no stranger to throwing the odd
little swear word in there. As a matter of fact, his last podcast had a couple in there. So, you know. You know. And they were very organic. That was from his guest. Okay. So,
all right.
You know. Yeah, obviously, you're censoring Stevie. Now, are you?
I have to have a word with him. Unfortunately, I've called him to the office.
I love it. He's coming to the office. So we had yet another one from Nikita. And this is all like after 5 a.m. in the morning, 4 a.m., whatever it is in the morning. As soon as this came out, before the polls even made it to the Spotify, I really enjoy getting to listen to the uncensored version of you guys. Keep the show the same. I love it. So that's a couple of
positives
to it.
I won't say I'm looking forward to seeing the negatives, but I would like to see negatives
of
if they come. And I want to know what they're saying.
So. Of course, they're not going to hide it from you, buddy.
Speaking of other podcasts, like we did D-O-L-O, mm-hmm. Dolo.
D-O-A-L-O. He says he hates that name. He doesn't like the shorthand. He called me about it the other day.
No.
Yeah.
It's funny because
I like it.
I was kind of iffy on it too, honestly, like when I first saw it.
Really?
I'm used to it now, so it's just there. You know
I love
mean?
It.
So.
Yeah.
Oh, man, I love Dolo. It's like ODJ. I mean, I love that short form, FNC.
Maybe he wants to just build that brand better and he doesn't want to hear that short form yet. You know what I mean? So maybe that's, you know, Stevie, he's working hard at it. So, you know.
All right. We'll take it under advisement.
Okay.
But speaking about the podcast network and all the other shows, There was, and I think I might have listened to this before the audience even had a chance to listen to it. And that was one of the D-O-L-O episodes, the Dolo episodes, Diaries of a Lodge Owner. And it was concerning something I didn't know about, but Crown Land Spring in forestry areas.
Yeah.
And his guest, James
Alofs. Yeah. I got halfway through the podcast, and it's quite interesting, and it's quite eye-opening, actually, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, we'd be foolish, though, to think that this kind of thing doesn't happen on a regular basis, right? I think we'd be foolish because big industry usually find ways of making their products and their, in this case, harvest a lot more effective. And
of course,
if you listen to this podcast,
sometimes they do whatever it takes too, though, right?
Right.
That's what this is kind of alluding to.
So it's episode 16. It's called "Should We Be Concerned About Crown Land Spring?" And it deals with what's going on right now in Ontario, apparently, where they're spraying glyphosates.
Yep. Herbicide. It's a herbicide, right?
It's a herbicide. What exactly does that mean?
You know that Roundup stuff that you...
Right.
That's the shit right there that they're spraying around.
That works good.
Yeah, it works real good. Kills everything. Right?
Did I tell you?
And it ain't good
stuff. Oh, my God. I got to tell you. I got to tell you a story real funny.
Okay.
So I'm never home. Right, all summer long, I'm on the road, so I've never been one to really look after my lawn and the garden
throughout
and all
the
that
summer.
Stuff, throughout the summer, so this year, I said, you know what? And my wife loves that stuff, right? She's always wearing. I said, this year, I'm going to make a real effort. Whenever I have time, I am going to go and I'm going to get that lawn looking like it's a golf course because I love the greens on a golf course.
Beautiful. Even the fairways, even the rough on some places.
So I did.
Right.
So early in the season, right after the snow was gone, I got into that first level of fertilizing and waking the grass up and gently, you know, doing all aerating it. Like I did the whole dealio, right? And lo and behold, within a couple of weeks, it was actually looking pretty damn good.
Mm-hmm.
So my wife thought she would help me. And I was proud of it, by the way. I'd come out in the morning and look at it.
In your robe?
Sometimes.
In slippers?
Sometimes.
Yeah.
And I'd say, my God, that is beautiful. I'm so glad I'm doing this, you know. And it was just gorgeous.
I can just see you doing it.
Just a gorgeous green. And I'm thinking the neighbors have got to be envious of me now, right? So anyways, I went away on a trip. We went shooting somewhere. I came back and it was a disaster. It was like a bomb field.
What do you mean? Like brown, like
brown, yellow, dirt, no grass in spots. It was like they dropped.
Come on. In a 1 week span.
Less, in a weekend. And why? What happened? My wife thought she'd help me.
Glyphosates.
Exactly. She went and there was still, you know, the odd little weed that was coming, still coming through, even after all the care I gave it. So she thought she'd be nice and she'd go to each one of those and dig it out and spray it with this stuff.
Roundup.
And she did about 20 of them in my lawn. Mm-hmm. And when I came back, it was a disaster. Absolute disaster.
That's what James and Stevie are talking about here. You can imagine on a high level. And these,
spraying
and
these,
areas, God. These clear cuts that they're talking about. And one of the things that was mentioned in there, I'm pretty sure the two biggest forestry companies are owned by China.
Yeah.
Or Chinese companies.
Yeah, of course.
You know what I mean? They're not even, and they're doing the work here. So there's probably influence of that too. You know what I mean? You know, our government, they're going to get they got to make some money too out of this. So
check out the podcast. It's episode 16. It is Diaries of a Lodge Owner. And the episode is called "Should We Be Concerned About Crown Land Spring?" And after you listen to this episode, I think the answer is going to be unanimously yes. Big time. So check it out.
Very quick too. To give you a little idea, just Google, is Roundup safe? That's all you have to Google. And check out the stuff that comes on that one.
I have to check that out myself. In the news on fishingcanada.com, in the news, fishing has positive benefits for men's mental health.
Hell yeah.
Come on.
Give me
dude.
A hell yeah.
Thank you, Steve. Yes. Yes, indeed.
Fishing has positive benefits for men's mental health study finds. Now, my first reaction.
Oh, here we go.
No.
Women, right?
Yeah. What's with the men's health?
Well, maybe the women are happy because the men are getting the hell out of the house, too, maybe. Could be, you know?
Maybe.
You know?
Anyways. Fascinating story. There was a study conducted by the Anglia Ruskin University in Cambridge, Ulster University, and Queen's University, Belfast.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't just one little Mickey Mouse group of people hanging
out. Like
it's a major international
collage of a bunch,
endeavor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And research conducted in the UK found that longtime fishing hobbyists could have likely... already told us this.
Of course.
And that is that they rated 17% less likely to report being diagnosed with mental health conditions compared to those who take part in the hobby.
Hmm.
So, and we've been saying this forever.
We've been saying it forever. The outdoors. You know what? You could take it from any one of us in this room going out by ourselves on the water.
Mm-hmm.
It's very therapeutic.
Mm-hmm.
To a group of all of us together going out in the water. We're all having a good time. It's just like, there's not a whole lot of negativity to it, right?
I can't see any way
that
it could be.
Breathing in the fresh air. You're away from the city. You're doing, even if you go fishing
stress.
In the city, even
just,
you go to a pond in the city, it's still,
stress alone would be.
And the outdoors, it's just like, I mean, when I was into photography a lot, I just get away, I just drive north of half an hour and start looking at what I could shoot out there and just saying, oh my God, this is just serenity. Mm. So I think it's all about, it's about nature more than it is about anything, I think. You know what I mean? Yeah. In a natural environment. And it's, I 100% believe that one.
So there 100%. You go. Fishingcanada.com. Check it out. It will confirm what we all already knew.
We get a study done on the ladies too next time. Maybe
I would say maybe is missing. You know. We need to find out how women react to the outdoors.
Mm.
I'm assuming it'll be fine.
Yeah.
Speaking of the outdoors, we also need to make sure that we preserve those same outdoors.
Yes, we
so
do.
So that we can have them for generations to come. One of the problems right now that we're currently faced is with invasive species. They seem to be all over the place. There's invasive species in everything. But particular one, it's called the grass carp, and it is here. It is beyond the southern border, and it is into Canada for sure at this point. We don't know whether they're reproducing yet or not, but they are definitely here. It's called the grass carp. And
they can take away. They could take away this therapeutic moment that we have. If there's no fishing, if there's no weeds, which these grass carp are eating, we have no fishing. Then we're going to go. Then we're going to start going a little bit into mental health problems, buddy. Think about that one.
I don't even want to think about that
transition.
One.
Not a good transition.
One of the things we can do as anglers and outdoors people is we can arm ourselves with education, especially in order to identify that critter.
Oh, there he is.
There he is right there on the screen.
He or she is.
Yeah.
It is.
It.
E.
First thing you'll notice, it's got a weird kind of a forehead / nose / weird positioning in the mouth. I mean, there's all kinds of weirdness on that fish.
Very much so.
But you would know it if that's fishing.
Because it looks, you know what it looks like? The body, it looks like a chub or it looks like a fall fish.
Yeah.
Very, very similar to both those. So you need to go to asiancarp.ca and see the difference between that and lookalike species. And do that, download it into your phone. And then when you get this lookalike species, you say, oh, no, that's not one. That's okay. And if it is a grass carp, you need to take care of business with that. How would they do that? What would they do?
Well, they could use the bonker if they wanted to, but then you're assuming that they're catching them. We don't know that that's even possible yet, right?
Well, you can accidentally
catches?
Snag it, yeah.
Yeah,
something
you don't
like
want
that,
people
maybe.
Going out doing that.
No, yeah. Accidentally.
Oh, accidentally.
It. If it's an incidental catch, it's not, you didn't even purposely snag it, right? So, yeah, then you just dispatch of it. And call the authorities, asiancarp.ca and Ministry of Natural Resources, whoever you can call it. Ministry of Natural Resources and Forestry, sorry.
F. Don't forget the F.
Yes.
All righty. Fan question of the week. Submitted by Tim Ekeres. Ekeres. Irks.
Earks or Erks?
Earks.
Sorry, Tim, about that. But
double E-R-K-E-S. Yep. Earks from Alberta via email. And we say email because you can send us messages in a multitude of different ways. Info at Fishing Canada is probably the most common that's being used now. But all of our social media array has opportunities for you to send these questions via those places as
yes,
well.
Indeed.
And each week what happens is that our good producer, Mr. Taylor, he pulls one out of the drum. And to hear, lo and behold, it ends up on our script.
It's a bunch of bullshit.
Well, there's that too.
Mr. Taylor. I like that, Mr. Taylor.
Sounds good, eh?
It does sound really good.
Mr. Taylor.
Like Mr. Bowman, it's whatever. Mr. Rail. Mr. Babushkin.
Mr. Babushkin. I like that too.
I like that
That's
one.
Pretty official sounding.
Yes, sir.
He wants to know, Tim wants to know, when fishing for walleye, now specifically when fishing for walleye, does a leader affect the use and presentation of a lure as it pertains to walleye?
Of course, I would say absolutely yes. It does affect the use and the presentation of a lure. I'm assuming Tim is talking a wire leader. Because nowadays, you got to remember, leaders broken down more than just for a fish biting you off. There's wire leaders. So in the pike world and the musky world, you use these so they don't bite you off. In our world now, we're using leaders to join braided line to fluorocarbon leader. Now the modern, probably a lot of younger people don't even know what a steel leader is. They don't even...
You think that's what Tim's
No,
asking?
I'm saying Tim is talking about pike and steel leaders.
No, he's talking about walleye. He's saying when fishing for walleye, a leader affect...
Why would Tim have a leader on?
Well, that was going to be my... See, I was hoping to draw that from you.
I was going
to
bring that up. I'm just saying now leader is a broader subject now.
You're
so
confusing
I'm saying that Tim is talking about a wire leader, not to be confused with Yozuri's pre-made leaders that are, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
You're confusing me.
Anyways, okay,
go ahead. May I attempt to answer, Tim? Would you mind?
Would
you mind? Sit back and enjoy. So,
well, that's a bunch of bullshit.
Tim.
That's a bunch of bullshit.
Tim, buddy. So, you say when fishing for walleye, does a leader affect? Why are you using a leader when fishing for walleye?
Because he doesn't want to break off.
Why?
He doesn't want to break off with pike because he's got pike in the lake.
Okay, so you're fishing pike. You're not fishing walleye. If you're walleye, well, you can't be afraid of breaking off the pike if you're fishing for walleye.
It's a $12 lure, and I got three. I only got one of them left.
But you bought the lure. You spent $12 on that lure because it's effective on catching a fish.
Well, I wasn't sure.
If you take away its action by putting a weight on the nose of that lure, you know... It's going to affect it.
There's no more in Alberta. I got the last one in Alberta, and I need to keep that lure on, but I still want to catch my walleye. Well, I have to use that leader because there's 10 pike to my one walleye in that lake.
Wow. So good luck. Good luck on the walleye catching.
He's asking, does it affect it?
Of course it affects it. Yeah. Every time you put something on the nose of a bait, you're going to affect the action. It was not intended to be fished with any weight forward of that nose.
Right.
And we're even to the point where the line diameter, never mind putting a leader on, but the line diameter and the line weight and the characteristic of the line, whether it's it tends to be a floating line or whether it tends to be, you know, a sinking line, even that will make a difference on a lot of these baits.
Makes a huge difference.
Right.
And visually, Tim, let's be honest. Let's look at that leader. I mean, let's take the basics of leaders, those stainless steel looking leaders.
Oh,
that's just nasty looking in the front.
Hate
so
leaders.
So when you travel way up north where the fish are biting like crazy, yeah, you can get away with a leader for sure. But the more educated the fish get, just the visibility alone makes it that much harder to get walleye to bite.
Now, if you're targeting pike, that's a whole different ballgame. You have no option. You have to have a leader.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to have a big, nasty-ass leader, not just a mm-hmm. leader. But if you're targeting walleye, I'm of the opinion, and I know my colleague sometimes agrees, sometimes doesn't agree with me, I'm of the opinion that take your chances. If you're worried about the pike biting your bait off, well, get over it. Right? You're there to fish walleye. You're there to fish walleye. So you've got to put yourself in the best mm-hmm. possible position to succeed at that. And that means no leader on your bait.
If, Tim, if you want to up your odds yet still using a leader, companies like Yozuri, who we work with, make leader material, fluorocarbon leader material. That's a better option. It's a less visible option than the wire leaders that are out there and stuff like that. So you can create your own. You can actually tie knot to the leader and then tie it actually to the lure. It's just, it's a thicker fluorocarbon. But, you know, I mean, it's you run a 60-pound test, 50-pound, 60-pound test fluorocarbon leader. That might up your odds a little bit better, too, so if you want to go that way.
All right. The moment is upon us. There's an adventure just outside these walls.
It's something you'll hate to leave and can't wait to get back to.
It's a place where memories are made and bonds are forged.
For some, it's hitting the trails. For others, it's a weekend at the lake. It's a place full of campfires and quality time.
This year, take some time to reconnect with friends, family, and nature. No matter what adventures await you, Coleman has the gear you need. Visit ColemanCanada.ca to gear up today.
The outside is calling.
Answer the call.
As the world gets louder and louder, the lessons of our natural world become harder and harder to hear. But they are still available to those who know where to listen. I'm Jerry Ouellette, and I was honored to serve as Ontario's Minister of Natural Resources. However, my journey into the woods didn't come from politics. Rather, it came from my time in the bush and a mushroom. In 2015, I was introduced to the birch-hungry fungus known as chaga, a tree conch, with centuries of medicinal use by indigenous peoples all over the globe. After nearly a decade of harvest, use, testimonials, and research, my skepticism has faded to obsession, and I now spend my life dedicated to improving the lives of others through natural means. But that's not what the show's about. My pursuit of this strange mushroom and my passion for the outdoors has brought me to the places and around the people that are shaped by our natural world. On Outdoor Journal Radio's Under the Canopy podcast, I'm going to take you along with me to see the places, meet the people that will help you find your outdoor passion and help you live a life close to nature and under the canopy. Find Under the Canopy now on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts.
And now the moment we've all been waiting for, especially me, I got to tell you, I am so excited.
No, especially both of us. Trust me on this one.
Our guest, there's not much you haven't heard about him. Although there's a few things that I just learned about Bill, and I've known him for years that I didn't know. We'll talk about it.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
That's a good story.
Joining us now is the living legend himself, Bill Dance. Billy, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing great, partners. How y'all two doing?
We're doing great, Bill.
We're
pumped, buddy.
We're pumped. I was telling my producer before we went on, I've been doing between live radio and podcasts, I've been doing this for 30 some odd years. And I only recall one other time where I felt this tingling, nervous feeling about an interview.
Wow. And that's when you did my interview, right?
And I don't know why, because I know you well. I just you're such a big persona,
absolutely,
in our world.
Absolutely.
And it's just a thrill to have you here, man. Just an absolute thrill.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
For folks who need a little bit of information, Bill, I think, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but he is the father of fishing television shows, some 55 years on air. And I don't,
wow.
There's
that's
never
awesome.
Been anybody that's done that, Bill, to my knowledge.
Gadabad Gaddis, who was sponsored years and years ago by Liberty Mutual, he was on for quite some time, but I don't think he was on near as long as we've been on. We've been running on the air from local to regional to syndication to a national program. A Bill Dance, a Bill Dance Freshwater, and then we started about 10 years ago with Bill Dance Saltwater. So Good both shows you. Are both shows are doing well. We started at a local station, an ABC affiliate in Memphis, and it was kind of a tussle to get it. But I went to the CBS affiliate, and they said, "Nah, we don't. There's no room for a fishing show in this market." And then I went to the NBC affiliate, and I was pretty discouraged. And I got home, and my wife doesn't believe in the words "I can't," and I just told her, I said, "I just don't think I can make this go." And she said, "Well, isn't Channel 13, aren't they an ABC, aren't they an ABC affiliate?" And I said, "Yeah." She said, "Why don't you go see them?" Well, fast forward, I did. And we started a local show in the Memphis market. And after about a year or two, we got a call from another ABC affiliate in Jackson, Mississippi. They said, "Well, will you do one for us?" And I said, "Sure." It was a good deal because we had the state capitol. We had access to the governor, who was a big fisherman, water safety, game and fish. And their sister station, WBRZ in Baton Rouge, said, "How about doing one for us?" Well, that was another good deal. And it wasn't long after that, we got a call from Paducah, Kentucky, and the manager of the JCPenney store, Jock Panay, they said, "How about doing one for us?" And I said, "Sure." Well, the long and short of it, we started, Memphis was the beginning. We were doing four markets, 52 weeks a year. Four times 52 is 208 shows a year.
Nice.
Yeah, but I would go to Baton Rouge and take four shows and get local people there, and I might shoot a couple of shows in the Chaffalau Basin or some of the lakes down there. I can't pronounce them. I was down there a week, and the only sign I could read in Louisiana was H&R Block. But we started it, and we did that for a period of time, and it just got to be such a hassle. I gave the Baton Rouge show up to a good buddy of mine, and he took over. And then in Jackson, I had another good buddy, and I gave him my show there. And then I finally quit the show in Paducah and just concentrated on Memphis. Then we got a call. Would I be interested in syndicating Bill Dance Outdoors? And
I was going to ask you that. Did the thought ever come up? Well, why am I doing seven or eight different shows? Why don't I do one show and feed all of these stations? Like, that would be the natural thought.
Yeah, but it was getting the guest and it gave it a local appeal.
Local.
Yeah. I couldn't get the Game and Fish from Jackson to Memphis and tape.
Right, right.
So anyway, we a short period of time after I quit that, I got a call from a syndicator in St. Louis, Don Stork, and Don said, "We'd like to syndicate your show." And I said, "Okay." And we syndicated in 50 markets, and then we went to 90 network markets. We did that for a while, and the cost of syndication just kept going up, up, up. And we moved to cable, and this has been back in the 70s. We moved to ESPN. And we ran on ESPN. I don't think there were any other fishing shows on ESPN at that time. And we worked that market. It was a great network, and it covered the country from Spokane, Washington, to San Diego, Los Angeles, Phoenix, Arizona, Dallas, Texas, Fort Worth, New Orleans, all the way down to Miami and all the way up the Eastern Seaboard and everything in between. And we did that for a period of time, but we saw that the demographics just wasn't there. And then there was a little network over in Nashville, Tennessee, called on TNN.
Yeah.
So we talked to them, and they said, "Let's go with it." So we moved Bill Dance Outdoors to the Nashville network, TNN. And Within a few weeks, we contacted several key sponsors. We contacted Walmart. They said, let's do it. We contacted Chevrolet. They said, let's do it. We contacted Purina. They said, let's do it. And we picked up some major hitters back then. And we ran on TNN till Gaylord Enterprises, Opryland, and that whole network. They sold out, and we moved to a little network up in Boston somewhere called the Outdoor Channel. I don't know what the Outdoor Channel is, something like that. But anyway, we ran with them for about a year, and then we finally moved to NBC Sports, to the Discovery Channel, and we picked up two other networks, the Outdoor Channel, which we're running on at the present time, along with the Sportsman Channel. So this, after about 10 years ago, I got the idea to try to do a saltwater show. And we kicked it off with the same basic format: education, entertainment. And when you can have that, I think you've got the best part of both worlds.
For sure.
Yep.
So we ran, started running our saltwater series about 10 years ago on the Sportsman Channel. So now we do 52 weeks a year on the Outdoor Channel and on the Sportsman Channel. And we run, we'll run, I think our programmer told me not recently, we'll run 1,140 times next year.
The show. Oh, 50 so, some odd years later, here you are still dominating. Well, I say dominating. There's a couple of friends of ours who might argue that. Roland and Jimmy. Roland and Jimmy might have something to say about that.
Yeah.
Are you listening, Roland? Awesome.
So, Bill, how many episodes of each show do you shoot per season?
We shoot 39 original shows a year.
Wow.
We shoot 26 fresh and 13 salt.
How the hell? Wow.
That is awesome.
How do you do that?
I don't know. With working with real good people.
Yeah.
Our production crew at Bill Dance Outdoors, we have two cameramen and we have three editors. And I've got my daughter and my niece really keep our shows going. We have a fellow that in Brownsville, Tennessee, that's our sponsor relation guy. And we've got, just trying to think, we've got just a bunch of good people that help us along to produce these shows. So
it's to produce that many shows. I think Pete and I,
Pete
and I did that for a short period of time.
That was 26 though, wasn't it? Or
it was 13 and 13. No, we started with 26 and 13, the first
so
the
same
two,
as Bill's doing
same
there.
As Bill's doing there. When we learned our lesson real quick.
Yeah, we tapped out real quick, Billy. That's it.
We cut that back to 13 and 13 did that for 9 years. And then we had to stop because it was brutal. It was absolutely brutal. That's why I say, how do you do that, my friend? I mean, it's incredible.
Well, we get a jump on it, and we've been doing it so long.
Yeah.
I mean, 55 years is a long time.
Right.
And if you could take a truckload of bricks, and if you threw enough of them, you could eventually curve one around a corner. So we've learned from experience.
Maybe you could, Bill. We can't do that, okay? There's no way we can do that.
If you chuck enough of them, you can.
Okay.
But we were fortunate that it seemed like when one door closed, another one opened.
Sure.
And we work with a lot of very, very talented people that are a whole lot smarter than me. And they help us along. You know, you're only good as the people you work with.
Without question.
Right.
Without question.
We've met a lot of guides that have become real close friends of me and our organization. And I fish with them, and I devote a lot of it toward education. Why are these redfish here now, and why are they here?
Yeah.
What do they do year round? What is the best tackle for them? Yeah. When is the best time to fish for them? And if it's sharks, inland, we do a lot of inland shows, but some offshore. But we found out that the inshore shows more people could relate to that and afford and can afford to do that, more so than going offshore. We do a few offshore shows. We just finished one in Orange Beach, Alabama, about 3 weeks ago, offshore, catching smaller fish on light tackle. And it was a real good show.
Nice.
And then we skipped over to Destin while we were in that area, and we knocked out a real good redfish show. So I'm scheduled next week to go to, got to make a stop in West Point for a meet and greet with Mossy Oak. And then we head to Florida, and we're trying to catch that early, early spawn, that largemouth bass spawn. And water temperature controls that so much. So we're going to try to start shooting a few freshwater shows for next year, this November. Nice. And then we'll leave there and scoot over to Palm Bay, Florida. The Space Coast is one of our big sponsors along at Cape Kennedy and Cape Canaveral, up to Bard County, which is the longest or the biggest county in Florida. We've got the St. John's River, we've got the Indian River, and we've got the Atlantic Ocean. So we've got quite a bit to choose from in that area. So we'll be over there for a week or so doing two or three shows. And we head home for Thanksgiving. And that
hopefully
coast from then on.
Nice.
One of the things earlier in your career, you know, if there was anything that was – that looked like a bit of a stumbling block is that people used to say, yeah, well, Billy's always fishing the same ponds and he's got the same fish and he's got the, and I used to defend the heck out of you, by the way, just so that you know. But my comment, now I understand a little bit on how you could do so many episodes, because one of the problems we have in what we do is the travel. It's excruciating. It's absolutely excruciating. So by eliminating some of that, I think, first of all, it's a very smart idea. And secondly, I think what you were doing, teaching us all how to catch fish, could only have been done under those conditions.
Yeah.
I don't think they could have been done any other way.
So educational. Those pieces were so educational. You didn't really care about the location.
No.
It doesn't matter to me.
No.
When Bill is telling you how to run a crankbait, you know, a medium running crankbait, with whatever, that's gold right there. You know what I mean? So
for sure.
Well, you know, we're not really trying to impress anybody how many fish we can catch in 30 minutes of television, because you only see just a small percentage.
Exactly.
Now, sometimes you see every one. Fishing is so tough that you have to, really work at it. But we're not trying to impress anybody, but more so educate people on why we use this type of equipment, why we'd use a medium action rod versus a light action or a heavy action rod, why we use braided line versus mono, how do you fish vegetation, certain types of vegetation, where it'd be lily pads, spatter dock, the coontail moss or whatever. But it's not where we fish. It's the educational aspect that we try to pass along. So we've been doing this, like I say, for a long time. And
it works.
That's for sure.
Education has been our number one gig. So and entertaining and talking about things that are important.
A big problem with Angie and I, we have, and this is to the audience as much as it is to Bill, is that we are really confined in that May to, you know, October maybe time frame right there. So whereas Bill can access all these waters year round, it's very nice.
Well,
for us to be open water fishing, we could throw an ice fishing show in there once in a while, but but to do, you know, another 13 episodes, it's so nice to be able to drive to these places, not just fly to, you know, easy access, get your whole Prince Craft boat for our sake in there.
Yeah.
So we don't have that that luxury. So that kind of stops us too, right? Stymies us a little bit. So
Bill, have you ever, you know, all these years I've known you, I've never asked you this. Have you ever produced a show in Canada?
That's one of my questions I had for Bill.
Yeah.
Good one.
Yeah, we've shot stuff up around Gatanaqua.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
On the St. Lawrence River. Yeah.
Nice.
And we've done stuff at Lake of the Woods.
Nice.
We've that's probably the only two areas that we've done in Canada on the St. Lawrence River.
Oh,
Man,
that up through New York, got an aqua over in that area, and then Lake of the Woods. We've done several things on Lake of the Woods over the years. And I used to do stuff with Al Linder up in Minnesota with the A guys. You know, I call them the walleye guys, but I've done several things with Al and on nothing in Canada. Nothing. I don't think Al and I ever went to Canada, but we've done stuff in Minnesota catching walleye and all that, all those type and smallmouth and fish up there at fish camp. He had a place up there that we excellent place. Done walleye shows with Al and
good stuff.
But Canada, that's about the only two places we've done anything.
Those are two good ones. Those are two dandy. St. Lawrence River and Lake of the Woods. You can't get much better than that. That's for sure. You know,
I tell a little joke from time to time, Bill, and I can't help but feel that it would be a perfect place to insert this right now. And
hello, let's go.
Sometimes when I'm having a rough time out there shooting a show, which we've all been, you know, through those days before.
Oh my God.
I turn to my crew and I say, you know, I could have been a doctor. You know, I could have, my mother wanted me to be a doctor, but no, I had to become a fisherman. And so then I say to the guys, you know, there's only one thing that kept me from being a successful a doctor. And they'd say, what? I did grade 7. But in your case, it's true. You were on the road to being a doctor.
Well, you know, my daddy was a doctor. My granddaddy, my great granddaddy, my great great granddaddy for 5 generations back were all doctors.
Wow.
And I gave it a lot of thought. My parents didn't try to direct me in that way, but I gave it a lot of thought and even looked at UT Med in this area to start with it. But I saw them. I was driving, if I tell you the name of the street, it wouldn't mean anything. But anyway, I was driving along, and there was a motorcycle in front of me. And a car came out of nowhere and just T-boned him. And I slammed on my brakes and jumped out and ran up to him. And it was the worst mess I've ever seen. It was horrible. And it just put an imprint in my head. I still see it today, but about the same time, a car stopped with 3 nurses in it. And then, wasn't a second or two, another car stopped, and a guy runs up and he said, "You're a doctor?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Okay, let me see what I can do." And then the police came and I said, "You need me anymore?" He said, "Just tell me exactly what you saw." And I explained it to him, and he could see how bad it was. And so I left, and I've never forgotten that. And when a day or two after that, I kept thinking back to that and what I saw. And I said, "Look, boo, there is no way this fat boy can be a doctor. Wow. I can't cut that."
Wow.
And so
it takes a special person.
Always wanting to get into the tackle business somehow, some way. And I finally, Ray Scott's tournaments came along, BASS. And I participated in that first tournament. And in Beaver Lake, it was a Highland Reservoir, which I wasn't really used to fishing because I grew up here in the Mississippi Delta. I fished Oxbow Lakes up and down the Mississippi, and if I caught a fish over 6 feet deep, that was deep back in those days.
Yeah.
But anyway, I went to Beaver and I started fishing and I tried to train myself. If I'm going to participate in these tournaments, I've got to learn how to fish deep water. And as a result, I caught my fish about today, it's no depth, 20 feet. But back then, most fishermen were bank fishermen. And I said, I've got to learn more and more about this. And I caught my fish in about 17 to 20 feet of water. a beaver. And I led the tournament for the first 2 days. And a good friend of mine, Stan Sloan, out of Nashville, he won the tournament and beat me by a pound or so. And the next tournament, I had a second at Kentucky Lake. And then the third tournament Ray had was at Smith Lake in Alabama, which was a deep, deep highland-type lake. And I finished second there. And I thought, good night. And Ray used to kid me. She's always a bridesmaid. And so the following year, Ray had a tournament. The first one, he went back to Smith Lake. And I won that one. And then about 6 weeks later, he had one at Rayburn, Sam Rayburn Reservoir in Texas. And I, fortunate enough, I won it. And then he came back to Ross Barnett at Jackson, Mississippi, and held one, and I won it. So I had 3 seconds and 3 firsts just out of the first 6 tournaments I fished.
Not bad. Not bad. Okay.
And but about a week later, I got a call from Head and Lure Company, Al Kennedy, and he said, we'd like to talk to you about going to work for us. And I said, Head and, boy, they're the pioneers in fishing lures, you know, the Lucky 13 and all those famous old-timey baits. And I went, good gracious. And it wasn't a couple of days later, I got a call from Jim Bagley in Winter Haven, Florida. And Jim said, like to talk to you about going to work for us. And I went, ooh, he made the Balsa baits. Right. And then a fella called me from Ken White, and he introduced himself, and he said, I work for Cream Lure Company in Tyler, Texas. And I said, yep. And Nick Cream asked me to reach out to you and see if there's a possibility you and your wife could fly down to Shreveport, and I'll pick you up there, and they'd like for you to come to Tyler and spend the weekend with them. Well, Nick Cream was the inventor of plastic worms.
Of course, yeah.
And 50% of the fish I was catching back then was probably on the plastic baits, plastic worms and creature baits and stuff, which Nick made. So Diane and I flew down to Shreveport. Ken picked us up. And Nick said, what I want to do, I want you to promote our worms in the tournaments and fish with some of the key buyers that we do work for and show them how to fish our worms. Well, he came out with a worm called the Shimmy Gal, and he made it in a 6, 7.5, and a 10 inch. And he said, I want to furnish you a car. Whatever you're making now, I want to double it. I went, Lord have mercy. And so I went to work for Nick, and I worked for Nick for a couple of years, fishing with a lot of fishing on Toledo Bend and Rayburn with a lot of his buyers. We didn't have a Walmart or Academies or big outlets back then like we do now. But we had specialized bait shops, mom and pops, and that were buying direct from Cream Lure Company back in those days. So I would take buyers from different stores. I'd take them fishing and show them how to fish a slip sinker worm. And it grew from there. And after about 2 years, I got to thinking, I said, you know, if I can do this for Nick, I can do it for myself. So I went to Nick and I told him what I wanted to do. And he said, I figured this day would come. He said, you see that door behind you? And I said, oh goodness, what's he going to tell me now? He said, it swings both ways. If it doesn't work out, Bill, you come back and you've got a place. You've got a place with us. And Nick was a sweet, sweet fellow, and his wife, Cosma Cream, just wonderful people. But I came back and I started. And it was back then, a good buddy of mine, Charles Spence, who had just bought Strike King Lure Company.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I went with him to get Strike King Lure Company equipment, which consisted of bobby pins, skirts, lid, a melting pot. And the guy that did it made spinnerbaits and various things. Well, Charles bought it. And it wasn't a short, just a little bit after that, Charles says, let's become partners. And I said, okay. And we had a handshake. And we started promoting Strike King. Wow. And this stayed, Charles and I had Strike King for a good period of time. And it got to a point where riders would call me and they'd say, we'd like to go fishing. And Charles would say, did they invite me? And I said, no, Charles. And it got to the point, I'm telling you, it got to the point where I felt so bad about going out and fishing with these riders. And I said, Charles, when I fish with the riders, they're promoting our bait. They're promoting our company. They're promoting Strike King. And he just couldn't. And I said, and I know I'm leaving you here to do all the work, but I'm helping promote. Well, it got to the point where I just got so upset about it. I just told him, I went in one day and I said, look, we started this thing with practically nothing. So what I want, you take it and run with it. And I went to work. Short time after that, I was talking to Cotton Cordell in Hot Springs, who made a lot of great lures and the Spot and the Redfin and umpteen other baits. And he offered me a whopping position. And he's the one, after I went to work for him, he's the one that called me one night and said, Bill, and I love Cotton. He was like a daddy. He was the greatest guy. He said, we need a fishing show. And I said, okay, great. I know the perfect guy for it. I travel with him some. We room together at the tournaments. He's a close friend. I've shot his camera a little bit with him. And he said, who are you talking about? And I said, the perfect guy for you to hire to do a fishing show. And he said, who's that? And I said, Jerry McInnes. You remember Jerry?
Yep.
Jerry was a close friend, a dear friend. He said, no. He said, I really like Jerry. I respect Jerry. Jerry's got a good show, but I want you to do it. And I said, what? I said, me do a fishing show until I said, that's like pouring perfume on a pig. I said, I can't even spell television, Cotton. He said, well, learn how, because I want you to do it. Well, that's when we started the roll, Memphis, Jackson, Baton Rouge, Paducah, and then we went off into syndication. So it worked out a dream that if you set your mind that you want to do something and you work real, real hard at it, you can accomplish a lot once you set your mind to it. So that really opened the door for me. And then I continued to fish tournaments. And but the television show was just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And how I wanted to do the show and the format. And that's where we are today on
saltwater
and freshwater.
Good for you. I had no idea he was in Strike King. I didn't know.
Bill, listening to that story, do you think that those opportunities are there today for young kids who want to grow up into this business of ours? Do you think that they can still aspire to do what you did?
Well, you know, it's amazing what you can do if you set your mind to it. But the competition is so, so much greater.
Right.
Today than it was when I started. And I get a lot of emails and texts from young fishermen that said, I want to get into this, and how do I go about it? And I said, well, the first thing you've got to consider is your education. And once you get a good education, you'll be able to do a lot of the things you can't do without a good education. And I said, it's hard. You have to come out on top. And sponsors look at it, well, what are your credentials? What have you done? And back then, I was real lucky that I was winning tournaments and placing high in tournaments. And that's what opened the door for me. But I keep telling people, younger people that want to get into this business, get your education first and then really concentrate on trying to be the best you can possibly be.
Yeah.
And that's what sponsors look at. They want to look at a guy that's got a good personality, a guy that can sell himself, a guy that's got a good track record and knows how to promote product and knows how to sell himself to the public. And
it's funny.
It's a lot tougher today than it was when I started.
Yeah.
When Warren started or when Jimmy started.
We say the same thing all the time. But it's funny, the common denominator seems to be, and this is the part I said at the beginning of when we brought you on, I said there's one thing I didn't know about Bill, and that's what I want to just touch on now. The common denominator for all of us seems to be tournament fishing.
Oh, it's big time.
Right? We owe our careers
to tournament fishing.
There's no question about it. You just told us the same story. I know Roland is the same. Jimmy is the same. Like, everybody that's in this industry owes their, I think, if not their success, certainly the opportunity came through tournament fishing.
Oh, yeah. It really did. I wouldn't be where I am today had it not been for tournament fishing. Yeah. It opened doors and closed doors and opened a bigger door.
Yeah.
And that when it closed, it even another door swung and I got a little bit better and better and better with it. So I got in at the right time.
And we say that all the time.
Yeah, for sure. You know, the odd thing about us too, though, Ange, is when you just mentioned that and For everybody, it's tournament fishing and it's bass tournament fishing. But the U.S., it makes sense. But with us, bass tournament guys that in a country that's very walleye-oriented, very trout, pike, musky, everything else, yet we still based it on bass tournaments. So that's odd, but it's true, though. It's cool.
I did not know, Bill. I did not know all these years I've known you. I did not know that you caught the very first BASS bass. I had no idea. Or that you won the very first Angler of the Year in 1970. I never knew that.
Well, second, first. That's a pretty good start to that. I don't think you can go wrong with that deal. Holy God. Wow.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Hey, Bill, how many 10-pound or 10-pound plus largemouth bass have you caught in your life? Have you got a number on that?
The biggest one I ever caught, here in my home state of Tennessee, it weighed 14.1.
Oh, my God.
And the biggest smallmouth I caught here in my home state of Tennessee was 8.5.
Oh, my God.
But I've been fortunate to have caught, several over 10. And I remember I had a 13-pounder and a couple of 12s and several 10s, but I've never kept up. I could probably go to my fishing log and look back and probably count them.
Do you feel you've accomplished everything that you set out to do that 55 years ago? Do you think you've reached to where you wanted to be? Are there still moments in Bill Dance's life where he says, man, I've still got to do this?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I love it.
When you get to a point when you start saying, well, I can't do this, you start turning brown. Well, I'm still green and I'm still going. And, when you turn brown, you're dead. So,
are you tired?
I have a lot of things that I enjoy doing. And I've got a couple of new techniques. I can't wait to
get back
to Florida that I want to try on bass that would apply to any place you fish in the United States, Canada, Mexico, wherever it is.
Is there an opportunity here to break some news?
Well, no, it's just a different technique that I use on crappie.
Yeah.
And then I've got a show titled Crappie, Why Not Bass? So it's when fish are suspended, I found that this technique works extremely well on suspended fish. And I'm anxious to try it. And if it works out, it'll be one of the new shows that we...
that's cool.
You've got everybody right now listening that's got their ear to the mic or the speaker so they don't miss any of this. You can't just say that without giving us a little bit of information.
Well, I can tell you this much. It's just a technique where you can present a bait to a suspended fish, which is non-aggressive.
Right.
And keep your offering in one spot.
And it's not a float.
It is a float.
It is.
Okay.
Yeah, I knew it was good.
Okay, good.
Good. Nice little slip float.
One spot.
Yeah.
But I did this one time years and years ago, and I found that I had fish on about a 7 foot or 10 foot contour line, and the fish were laying in at about 7 feet. And I went down this section of bank and I caught quite a few fish and a few nice fish in 7 feet of water. Well, the next day we had a front that blew in. We had blue skies, strong north winds. And I went back to that bank and I went down it, and I don't think I even caught a fish. And I went to a similar bank, went down it, and I didn't catch a fish. And I came back to that bank, and as I dropped my trolling motor, I started in, and I looked on my graph, and I saw fish suspended at 7 feet. Well, the front didn't change the water temperature. Yep. It just changed the mood of the fish with the pressure systems. And all they did was to leave the 7 foot water and move straight out. I mean, just straight out 7 feet deep over 18 feet of water. And that's when I got the idea. I tried crankbaits. I tried suspending baits, running stuff through it. And I said, am I above them or am I below them? And bass like to feed in an upward position. And I've seen them go down on something and then kind of back up and look at it a little sideways to get, you know, to see it
better.
Yeah,
yeah.
So their eyes are fixed to feed up. But anyway, I tried this method for about 20 minutes, and I got kind of discouraged because I just knew it would work. Well, it didn't. And after about 20 minutes, I told the cameraman in the back of the boat, I said, doggone it, there's got to be a way to catch these inactive bass. And I tried to throw out and count the bait down and swim it through them. They wouldn't touch it. So I came up with the idea to use this method and another method where I could present a bait right on their depth level or just a shade above their depth level and make them bite it. Well, about the time I was just about ready to quit and do something else, boom, I caught one. And I got so excited about it. And these were some really nice fish. They'd go from, well, I caught one 9-pounder doing it. And I hung 11, I hung 12 fish doing it. I jumped one off, one broke off, and had two jump off. So I caught nine. I caught nine doing this with this technique. And they went from 3 to 9 pounds.
Nice.
And I thought, boy, this technique, this is some bad stuff. This will really work on suspended fish that are inactive, and you can keep your offering in front of them or just above them for as long as you want to.
Yeah.
Eventually, you can make non-aggressive fish bite. So it worked, and I'm going to do it again with a little bit different twist. And
it works like crazy.
And he get started on crappie, which is the perfect way to learn it. You know, you watch the crappies, you put it above their heads, and they can't resist it.
But I remember years ago, I think you were on the shoot with me. I can't remember for sure, but we were hurting bad, and we were in a really remote lake. But for whatever reason, we couldn't get, and we were walleye fishing. We couldn't get those fish to bite. And eventually, somehow, we started floating Do you remember this at all? We started floating.
Well, we've used lip floats for walleye with leech many times.
But this particular one. And it was the only way we could catch them in a bit of a narrow down area of the lake between an island and mainland.
In Manitoba. We were in Manitoba.
That's it. Do you remember that?
Yep.
It was so uncanny, Bill. These fish would not bite any way at all except with this float.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And it had to be very precise.
I can see that. I understand that 100%.
They were suspended and they were feeding up. Yeah. Exactly what Bill said.
Exactly what you said.
Yeah.
We
throw a crankbait and a pike would eat it.
Yeah.
Hey, exactly. We couldn't get any walleye in there. We get a pike. Get out of here. So,
Bill, I hate doing it because you've been asked about this a million times, but I need you to tell the audience the significance of that hat.
I was going to say the same thing.
Well, my love for Tennessee kind of grew up with Johnny Majors. I grew up in the same little town that the Majors, Johnny Majors became an All-American. He went to Pittsburgh, he left Tennessee. He went to Pittsburgh and became Coach of the Year, came back to Tennessee. And everything I did, I just loved Tennessee football, college football. And I ran around with one of his younger brothers, Larry Majors. But John's first job, he worked, did quite a bit of work for my granddaddy. And they lived next door to my great-grandmother. So the love for the sport, knowing the Majors, Shirley Majors, the daughter. Shirley Ann was the daughter, but her daddy was it was Shirley Majors. And Shirley Majors was the coach of the Lynchburg Raiders he was undefeated for 4 years.
Wow.
And then he left and he went to Huntland, Tennessee, and became a coach. And then they asked him to come to Sewanee, Tennessee, and at college, but then he moved on to the University of Tennessee as a head coach. But at that time, they had a big family. John was playing football. He had already left Tennessee, and he was playing pro, and he played for a Canadian league right after that. So at this time, he was playing for a Canadian league. Joe, his brother, was playing at LSU. He had another brother, Larry, which was my age, was playing he was playing at Sewanee and then went on to UT as a tailback when they ran a single wing. And then he moved on, his younger brother, Bob, was at Huntland, and Elizabeth Majors, the mother, she was in charge of ticket sales at Huntland. Shirley Ann, the daughter, was a cheerleader at Huntland, and the dog was the team's mascot. So everybody in that family was related with football. So I got a call one day after John had left Tennessee. And a guy said, I'm going to ask you something. His name was Doug Matthews. He said, can you help us? And I said, well, what can I do? And he said, we got a young man that has mixed emotions, whether to sign with LSU, Florida, Alabama, whoever it was, or Tennessee, and he likes to fish. Would you call him and talk to him? So I called him and I started talking to him and I told him what Tennessee had to offer, our great state and our lakes and our rivers and our creeks and University of Tennessee on the bank of the Tennessee River. And I was dead serious when I said, if y'all play Memphis State, at that time it's called the University of Memphis now, and you come, maybe we could spend a half a day, and I'm sure the coaches would allow it. We'll go somewhere and go fishing. And I was serious about it. Well, his schedule never could compete, line up with my schedule, and my schedule couldn't get with his schedule. But we communicated, and he did sign with Tennessee. His name was Randy Sanders. And then Randy eventually came offensive coordinator for Tennessee, and then he moved on. But we kept a close relationship. So one day in the mail, I opened a box, and there were two teacups in there, just like this one. And I wore that cap to one. I can't remember the first tournament I wore to. I think it was Ross Barnett. Anyway, I wore it, and I won that tournament. And somebody said, you know, that's your lucky cap. And I just started wearing it.
Wow.
I called Doug Matthew. I said, Doug, I need a few more of those caps. And he said, okay. I said, mine looks like they need an oil change.
How many have you had through the years? How many caps do you figure you've – because they got to wear out.
Well, they do, but we buy about 2,500 caps, and we autograph so many caps for people.
Oh,
and
that's cool.
We sell the cap. And
nice.
That's cool. But it's we've gone through umpteen jillion of them.
Oh, Bill, have you ever wore another cap when you're in your fishing career? Is that the only one you wear? Like, is there any sponsored cap or anything else, or do you restrict Tennessee?
I had back in those days, I had a cap that it said Perkins Automotive Sales, and I wore that cap up until I started wearing this teacup. But you know, it's kind of been a blessing. Sponsors would say Mercury or whoever it is, Bass Pro or whoever it was, an agency would be doing commercials, and you'd have one of the agency people says, can we shoot that without your cap on? And other agency would say, sponsor wants you to wear that cap. And so I got away. I didn't have to wear a bunch of different caps.
It's become part of your persona. I mean, absolutely. You without that hat, I would like, no.
Yeah, that's why I ask. Because, I mean, in our situation, we wear them all, and plus our own Fishing Canada hats. But Billy's got the old tea cap forever. That's so awesome. That's a great story.
They sent, I remember Doug Dickey sent me, he was the, he, after John, Doug Dickey was coach at UT, and that's when I got those first two teacups. And then Doug went on, he left Tennessee and went to Florida. I think he coached Florida, and then he was Florida's, University of Florida's AD. And then he came back to Tennessee as Tennessee's AD. But Doug, Coach Dickey now, is living in Tallahassee, Florida. And I talked to him a couple of times last year, and he's retired. Yeah. And he lives in Florida, but his heart's in Tennessee, so.
We interrupt this program to bring you the much-anticipated bonus code for the latest Fishing Canada giveaways. This week's code is DANCE. That's all capitals, DANCE, DANCE. Just type that in the bonus code section of the contest and receive 100 free entries towards all of our current giveaways. For those of you who aren't entered yet, what are you waiting for? Head over to fishingcanada.com while you listen to the rest of this episode. Click contests and sign up for all the latest Fishing Canada giveaways. And now, back to the episode.
Speaking of Florida.
Yeah.
Off the cuff, I want your very best Roland Martin story.
Well, you know, I fish for the fish that eat the fish he fishes for. So
that's all you have to say right there. Oh, that's so awesome.
Yeah, you can tell Roland that.
Oh, God.
What did you say? I said, I fish for the fish that eat the fish you fish for. What does that mean? Roland is a good friend. And,
I know.
He's a great guy.
We've had a lot of great times together. He's a phenomenal bass fisherman. He can adapt to lowland lakes, midland lakes, highland lakes, summer, fall, winter, spring, cold water, hot water, cold water, muddy water, clear water. hot water. He can, Roland can, he's just amazing in his ability to catch fish. So we have been good friends for a long, long time. And we do a lot of promotions together for our sponsors, Bass Pro. And I'm trying to think. I remember we were one night, we were at SeaWorld in Florida, and it was Roland, four or five of the fishermen on TNN. And we were doing interviews there from SeaWorld. And they had a big lighted area and everything. And I had one of the producers come over and say, Bill, I want you to tell us about a water and how fish relate to water. Just come up with some kind of crazy thing. And I said, okay, I know what to do. So the camera came to me and said, what are one of the, can you think of anything that's that you could tell the public that would help them with their fishing? And I said, well, let me say that, and I just started rambling. I literally started rambling. I said, well, you know, when you take the neutrality of water at 7 parts per million and anything above that leans toward acidity, and anything below neutrality relates to plankton or algae plankton. And he said, and I'm just making stuff up. And I said, now, when you get an upwelling of water, it forces stranger currents, because cold water is heavier than warmer water. And when this strange occurrence takes place, cold water falls through warmer water. And I said, you get these upwellings and these stratas that form. And I said, wait a minute. This question is so simple. It is just so simple. I'm going to let my good friend Roland Martin answer it. And he looked at me and said, what? Like a cow looking at a new gate. And he said, what? I said, yeah, it's so simple, bro. You know, that answer. And he went, I don't even know what you're talking about.
That's awesome.
I mean, I used terms that I don't even know what I was talking about.
Oh, that's hilarious.
And another guy sitting on the set, they looked at me like, what is he talking about?
Yeah.
I got rolling pretty good. You know, he said, you ever do me that way again, I'll kill you. But Roland is
he's special.
Roland,
he's special.
He's special for sure. Yeah.
Jimmy Houston tells us a story just hilarious about the three of you. Not that long ago, a few years back, we're on a boat fishing together, shooting a show. I don't know whether it was for Jimmy, for you, or for Roland. And Roland got hung up. He went to make a cast, and his back cast got caught up in your hat or your head or whatever. And he wanted to take the hook out. Well, when Jimmy tells that story, I'm telling
it's
you.
It's the funniest thing ever.
It's the funniest thing you've ever heard in your life.
We were all in the boat together, and Roland just gets so excited, you know, when he does stuff. And he had a 2 ounce.
Oh, God.
He had a 2 ounce lead head on.
He wanted to get farther. Oh, my God.
And a lead head jig on.
Yeah.
And he turned and he says, well, there's a strong current going there. Look, that's got to be a good spot. And he says, and he goes, went, made the cast, and that jig hit me right in the back of the head and went, boom, like that. And I went, I just rocked. And he went, don't come home. I said, ho. I said, don't, quit jerking, Roland. And he said, huh? I said, quit jerking. The hook's hung. He said, I know it. Where's it? I said, it's hung in my head, dummy. And he said, I'll get it out. I said, no, wait a minute. I know how to take a hook out. I can pull it out at a 60-degree angle the way it went in, and it won't bleed very much, and it won't tear up any tissue. Well, he runs back there like Dr. Good Know-It-All, and he had a pair of needle-nose pliers, and he said, He said, hold your head down. He went, and I said, quit jerking. And Jimmy was over there screaming, and blood was just running down the back of my neck. And he said, I'll get it out. And I said, well, you jerk that thing one more time, I'm going to stick those pliers where the sun don't shine. I said, quit jerking. And finally he said, it went in, it's got to come out. And then he popped it out, and then blood just poured out. And Jimmy over there was just howling.
Oh,
and
when he tells that story, Billy, I'm telling you.
Jimmy can tell it well.
It's just the funniest thing in the world.
Bill did a pretty good job of it there, yeah. I got to say.
I had my hands up there like this. Jimmy had his hands in there. And then Roland had pliers. And it looked like I was in surgery with all these nurses and doctors with hands moving on.
Oh, my God.
My goodness. We've
had some good times. And they're good friends. We do a lot of promotional work together. And,
I got to tell you something, and I've told Roland this and Jimmy, and I'll tell you, I've been blessed with knowing you guys for a number of years since I got into business.
Thank you.
And aside from your personalities, which goes without saying, you guys are just incredible characters. But what I love about you guys is the camaraderie that the three of you have. Considering that you are your competitors.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You compete against each other at all levels, professionally during tournament days, getting into the broadcast business. You're competing for broadcasters.
Sponsors.
You're competing for sponsors. You're competing
everything.
For audience.
Yeah.
Like, you guys are the biggest competitors on the planet between the three. And yet, you can see the genuine love. You can see the affection that you have. And I look at it from afar and I admire it so much. To me, it's the biggest, my opinion, it's the best thing about the three of you guys is the friendship that you have and the way you.
Absolutely.
You got to throw Hank in there, Parker. I love Hank. But we've got, we try to help each other.
Right.
I've helped Jimmy with sponsors and, he's helped me. I've helped Roland. Roland's helped me. Yeah. We do stuff together. They know that I've got a particular sponsor that doesn't conflict with their sponsorship. And they'll even mention my sponsor to try to help me out.
Right.
And we kind of work that way together. But
that's pretty awesome.
It's wonderful, man.
Doesn't happen here. That's for sure.
That's what friends do. They try to help each other.
And
Roland's helped me, and I've helped Roland. I've helped Jimmy. Jimmy's helped me. I've helped Jimmy. And I remember, I can remember a tournament one time. Roland told me, he said, are you doing any good? And I said, dog on the phone. you hear that loon?
No, it didn't even come through. You're good.
Okay.
You're good.
But what was I saying?
So Roland asked you if you were doing any good in the tournament.
Oh, yeah. And he said, you done anything? You found anything? And I said, no, I don't think they're on a shallow pattern. He said, Bill, they're not. He said, you need to get out in deeper water. And he said, I'm telling you, it's a big difference. These fish have moved a considerable distance. And I was down here 2 weeks ago practicing, but they've dropped off into a deeper depths of 15, 18 feet, whatever it was. And I said, and they want a slow presentation bait. And I said, like a worm or a jig. And he said, absolutely. Well, he helped me. And I felt bad because
you beat him, right?
I beat him. I didn't. It doesn't happen often. It didn't happen often, but I beat him. And I gave him credit for, I said, he got me on the right pattern, on the depth pattern.
Nice.
And but I remember Roland. We roomed together at Table Rock Lake back in 1970 or 74, in those early 70s. And we were at Table Rock, and a cold front moved in. I mean, a bad one. And it was in the fall, late fall. And Roland and I were standing I don't know, under a tree or where we were. We were outside, and he looked and he said, "Look at that little dumpy guy, all wrapped up." And he said, "I don't know how he can fish." And I said, "Well, that ain't a he. That's a girl." And he said, "What?" And I said, "That's a girl." And he said, "It's not a girl. A girl ain't going to be out here in this kind of weather fishing." And I said, "Mary Ann." She said, "Hey, Bill." I said, "Come here a minute." And she walked up, and she had a toboggan on, and she pulled it off, and she had long black hair, and she just kind of shook her head, and Roland went, "Oh." And I said, "This is Roland Martin." She said, "How are you, Roland?" And Roland said, I said, "She just asked you a question, Roland." And Roland was, and we talked there a minute. And she said, "Glad to meet you, Roland." And Bill, and I said, her name was Mary Ann Colbert.
Yep.
Colbert. And she went on, and I went on, and I said, "Is your daddy fishing the tournament, Paul?" And she said, "Yeah, daddy is." And I was just out trying to look around and see if I could find a few fish for him. And she walked away. Roland said, "That's the prettiest girl I've ever seen in my life. I mean, she's beautiful." And I had to go back talking about it. He said, "Did you not hear what I just said?" I said, "Yeah, you said Mary Ann's a beautiful girl, and you're right, she is." So we got back to the cabin. Roland said, "I wonder if she'd go out on a date with me." I said, "All you got to do is ask her." So he changed clothes.
You know what's coming, right?
Where was she staying? I said, cabin's five or whatever it was. And he put on his little smell good perfume or whatever, cologne. And he took off and he went out the door. And he comes running back and he said, "She said she'd go out with him. We're going out tonight. We're going over to Kimberly City and have a Coke and maybe eat a sandwich." And I said, "Great." So he did. And he came in, and that's all we could talk about. "Oh, she's the sweetest thing. I'm telling you what, he just couldn't get over." So the next night, I said, "Why don't you, you don't want to let a good thing go by. I want you to take her out again." "You know, I think I will." So he runs over there. She said, "Sure." So they went out again. Well, the next night was the tournament. And he said, "Guess what? We're going out tonight." And I said, "Okay." Well, he stumbles in about 1 o'clock in the morning.
Before the tournament blast off, right?
And we got a tournament.
Yeah.
The next day. And so I said, "Good night, Roland, I tell you." So he goes in the bathroom, brushes teeth, whatever he was going to do. And so I reached over and I turned the alarm. I turned it up an hour. And I said, "Good gracious." And he said, "Turn a light on." I said, "No, wake me up." He said, "Okay, I'm fine." I said, "You know, we got to get up at 5:30. And he said, "Yeah, I know it. I got to get some sleep." Well, the alarm goes off an hour earlier, you know, and he says, "Whew, I feel like I just went to bed." And I said to myself, "You did." And so the next night, I set it back an hour and a half. We weren't supposed to get up till he'd be getting up at 3:30. And then he gets in. He took her out again that night before. And anyway, he got up the next morning and he says, "Boy, I am wore out." He said, "What time is it?" I said, "We ain't got very long to go. We got to get over to the weigh-in. And they've got a briefing up at the marina." "Okay." And we go to the, and I knew if I was going to do good in that tournament, I had to beat one guy.
Roland.
You doggone right. And so we walked out, and he says, "Boy, it's cold." And I said, "I know it. It was 28 degrees. And that was cold down here." And I said, "Okay." So we get over to the marina, and he says, "Where's everybody?" And I said, "Oh, they'll be here probably in the next few minutes or so." He said, "Are you sure this is where we're supposed to meet?" And I said, "Yeah, I know we are." Then at that time, a couple of guys started coming in. And Roland was going, "Oh, man, I feel like I didn't get any sleep last night. I said, you did. You got 2 hours. And I believe the only way I thought I won that tournament, and he finished second. It's the truth. And so he went.
Oh, my God.
He said, I have never in my life fished a tournament where I was so tired.
Oh.
And I said, oh, that's a shame. That's a shame. And I didn't tell him that for several years. And I told him what I did. And he said, you know, I'd have beat you if you hadn't have done that. I couldn't concentrate. I'd sit in the boat as cold as it was, you know, and my eyes would just start closing. I'd shake my head and even put my hand in the water and rubbed it on my face. Of course, it was cold. I'm telling you, it was literally cold. But anyway.
Man, that is, you know, those are some of the great stories that you can only get from involving yourself in tournament fishing, because I've got so many of those stories that we've gone.
Can you imagine how many him and Jimmy and Roland and Hank Parker have all together?
Oh my God.
That would be, it'd be a whole crazy life of stories, man. That's unreal.
Bill.
McKinnis one night, he comes in, we were rooming together, Jerry and I, on Lake Washita. We had a big tournament there. And he comes in the room and he says, Bill, you're not going to believe this. You're not going to believe this. I found the biggest school of bass I've ever found in my life. You think they'll stay there till tomorrow? And I said, I don't even know where you're fishing. He said, I'm fishing up Big Blakely. And I said, oh, okay. He said, you know that big, big point on the right that comes in, that timbered point? And I said, yeah. And there's a big field, looks like a mowed field out behind it. He said, yeah. He said, I pulled up there and it is loaded with bass, anywhere from 2 to 5 feet of water. And I said, and I've never seen Jerry so motivated, so happy. And went to bed that night and he got up the next morning. He says, I hope they stay there. I hope they can stay there. I said, well, if they're not there, they're either going to move down the bank in toward the cove, or they're going to move out or come out deep. Just fool around there and go a little bit deeper, go down the lake a little bit off the point, go the other way. He said, okay. So that afternoon we came in and I saw him walking down the dock. He had his head down. And Jerry, you just have to know Jerry, he gets so depressed. And so he walked by and I said, how'd you do? Oh my goodness. I pulled up there and there was 25 cows waiting around on that pole. And I said, what? He said, yeah. There was at least 20 or 25 cows all out, walking up and down that 2 and 3 foot water.
Oh.
And he said, it killed it. I never caught a fish there. And I said, well, where are you going? He said, I'm going to go around here and get my boat and take it on over to the marina where it was. And I said, okay, I'll see you at the cabin in a little bit. So I was fortunate. I won that tournament. And so I was in my room in cabin 7. I mean, not cabin, but I was in room 7. And it was a big area and at that motel there at the marina. And at Blakely Mountain, they had rooms and the marina and everything. But I was in room 7. Well, when I walked in the room, Nan, Jerry's wife, was standing there. I said, good night. What are you doing here? And she said, Jerry called me last night, and he was so excited. They said, never found a bunch of big fish before, and he thinks he's going to do real good in the tournament tomorrow. And I said, yeah. Unfortunately, an accident, they moved. She said, well, congratulations. I hear you did well. And I said, yeah, I got lucky. And so we were standing there, and I heard Jerry walking down the walkway. In cabin 5, Ray Scott, the promoter of BASS, right, the founder of BASS, he was in room 5. And I could hear him talking. And I said, come here quick, man. Come here quick. And I grabbed a bedspread and I just threw it back. I said, jump in that bed. Jump in the bed real quick. So she jumped in bed and I jumped in with her. And you could hear Jerry still talking to Ray. And I said, get on the cover, get on the cover. So I pulled the cover up over our heads. And Jerry walked in and he says, who is that over there? Bill? And I pulled the cover just right up to my eyes, and I looked, and I said, oh, my God. And I threw it back over my head. I said, oh, my God. She said, what? And I said, your husband's at the door. He's coming in the room. And she said, oh, my gosh. And he said, what's going on? So she pulled the cover down. So we pulled the cover down.
Oh, my God.
Here she is laying beside me. And
oh, my God.
McInnes went. He just busted out. He broke him down. He just started laughing and getting over that defeat. And he stuck his head back and he said, Ray. Hey, Scott, come here quick. So Ray comes running down there and Ray stuck his head in the room. And here we are laying in bed together with the bed. And Ray said, that's just like him. I've known him for years. Dance, you're nothing but a pervert. And then he walked off. We had so many funny fishing stories and tales.
People don't realize that happens on tournament circuits all the time. And it's the backstory that you never hear about. But it was every bit as fulfilling as those days out in the water competing. It's what happened when you got off with your buddy, with your competitor. Just wonderful memories.
I wonder if it still goes on in the modern era of tournament fishing.
I don't know.
It's hard to say. I mean, there's great guys out there. Yeah. We know some of them too. So
speaking of modern eras, though, Bill, I have to ask you this question not because you're old, God forbid, but what in Europe? You've seen everything in the fishing world from start to finish, right? We were from where we were using a one rod with a piece of string on it and catching fish, and now, of course, we're into some of the most incredible cutting edge technology available. What do you think has been the one biggest improvement that mankind has made in fishing that we've been able to take advantage of?
You know, there's a lot. And when I look back at the outboard motors, now that we got four strokes, quieter motors, better fuel efficiency. I look at the boats that we've got today, how well built they are, and how much storage they have, how much more comfortable they are to ride in rough water. I look at our rods today. They're lighter. They're more sensitive. They're strong. I look at our reels, faster gear ratios. I look at the advancement in fluorocarbon lines, braided lines, and monos. I look at our hooks. We've got thinner wire hooks that are extremely sharp, that penetrate quick. I look at all the things, but the one thing that I did not mention is our electronics.
Mm-hmm.
Our electronics are so far advanced today compared to what we used to use, a flasher. And I used a flasher. I couldn't read if it was fish or if it was brush, but I could read the depth. And that's what I concentrated on back in the early days when I had a flasher unit. But today, with the advancement in our technology and graphs, it's absolutely amazing. The GPS features, the waypoints, the fish it shows, the definition, of how accurate they are and how they can even draw. We're using them on the Mississippi River for catfishing, for instance. You can almost make a catfish out, his body. The things are so accurate.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You see bridges, you see sunken cars, you see that, and fishermen are capitalizing on that. And now with our depth, you know, our graphs compared to what we had from depth finders, now to graphs. I look at the side views of the all the technology that Garmin is my sponsor, and their technology is just phenomenal with what they're doing now and what they've got on the drawing board. As far as what they're going to introduce and what they will be introducing.
Yeah.
The power of our trolling motors, we've gone to 36 volts. Our batteries now, we're not using acid cell batteries as much as we're using, I can't even think.
Lithium.
Lithium.
Lithium, that's it. That's the word. That's, biggest two words I know are Chevrolet and mayonnaise. And I can't even spell it. Lithium, that's the word. Don't ask me to spell it. But our advancements in technology and in our equipment and how we fish bodies of water.
Absolutely.
The education that we've learned makes it so much easier than it was way back yonder.
Yep. True enough. For sure.
My friend, I can't thank you enough for sharing this time with us. We've gone way over what we asked you to give us.
And
we appreciate that so much. I'm looking forward to the next opportunity that we have to do some face-to-face time, probably at ICAST in July. Sure. Coming up.
Absolutely.
I say this with my heart and every fiber in my body. If we can ever do anything here in Canada with you, would love the opportunity to show you some of what we do here.
I'd love to see it.
So if we can ever make that happen, I know you're incredibly busy man, but if you ever think about it, let us know. We would love to spend some time with you up here.
Well, that's sweet of you, and I certainly appreciate it. And if you ever come or get close to our great state of Tennessee, you just anything we can do for you here, let us know. Because we got a wonderful state. We've got some great lakes with a multitude of fish to fish for. So if you get close and I can help you, please give me a call.
Excellent. Right on. Thanks, Bill.
Bill, thank you very much. We will chat at you soon. You take care. Say hi to everybody down there for us, and we'll talk, Dave.
I will. Thank you. All right. Enjoyed talking to you and to your listeners.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thanks, Bill.
Bill Dance.
The legend.
The extraordinary, the living legend, Bill Dance.
What a great guy. Wow. Stories. When Bill starts telling stories.
Well, that story that he was talking about, Roland.
Roland
had told me that already, right?
Yeah.
So I knew where it was going.
Didn't Jimmy tell it the first time?
Maybe Jimmy told us. I don't know.
Because Jimmy get even more animated, I think, than anybody. Jimmy,
but it is so funny.
Oh, my God.
The three of them is just.
You can just imagine. But just, like Bill just said, stop jerking. The way he would be. Oh my God, it would be so good.
You know, I don't know whether it would have ever been possible. Maybe the dynamics were all different. I don't know. But boy, it would have been great to have that kind of relationship that the three of them have growing up. They built the industry.
Of course they did.
You know,
that is it for
Wouldn't
sure.
Wouldn't it have been great to have that kind of relationship that they had here in Canada with our peers growing up?
Absolutely. We tried, you and I and
I know.
Mikey Burris and I and I Reno know. And yourself, you
yep.
know what I mean?
Yep.
And I'm sure the competitors that we've had throughout time, they maybe have had, but it's never been a real big group effort, and it was certainly not like they had.
They love
like,
each other.
Yeah.
They
yeah.
love each other.
To this day, they still do. To That's this the best day. Part of it. You know what I mean? It's lasted that long. And they all of these guys have done so well, and they've done tons for the industry.
Oh,
you know what I mean? Tons. And maybe a lot of the Canadians that are listening here might not now, the you know, younger people might not know so much about Bill Dance, but I'll tell you what, historically, man, those guys.
Did you hear his stories about the people that he grew up with?
How does he remember all those names?
Oh my God. One thing about Bill, I will tell you.
Wow.
I told you this before. It's uncanny. He remembers stuff so clearly. It's spooky.
It was spooky.
People's names. You know how you and I are bad for names?
Oh, my God.
He remembers people's names from, you know, that he hasn't seen in 2-3 years.
Talked with that whole family there in the football.
Exactly.
Like every name is like the dog's name.
Exactly.
It's like, God. Good
but
for him.
But that's Bill Dance. That's part of his makeup, right?
Yeah.
It's part of what...
Long
overdue. I've been dreaming about this moment when we could have him on the show. Obviously, I'm a little bit giddy, like a big fan. But I'm a big fan of his.
Any idea how old Bill is?
He's 83.
Okay, well, that's up there, though.
Yeah, he's same age as Roland. I think he's 2 months older than Roland.
Okay.
But...
Good for him. 83, still going.
Talking to him.
36. I mean, what is he? 36 shows a year?
Now, I think he's at 39.
Or 39? Yeah. Whatever it was. That's at 83 years old.
I can't even
My
imagine.
My God.
I cannot even imagine that.
13.
Dean, are you over the big fan shock?
Yep. I was nervous as well.
That's great, man. And I noticed you didn't push any of those buttons while Bill was dying.
I was nice and quiet.
Should have did a bunch of bullshit to Bill. That would have been
I didn't know how you would take it.
Yeah, good call on that one.
He'd probably laugh his ass off at it. He's got a great sense of humor. So,
anyways, thank you very much for sharing that with us through the audience. I'm talking now. It was a great moment for us. And Pete, you know, what can I say? Into us. Let us know what you thought of Bill. And if you knew him from prior to this or if you just met him on this podcast, I'd be interested to find out your views.
I think everybody knows Bill from the bloopers tapes too, right?
We never even got to the bloopers tapes.
4 million plus views on YouTube on each volume of his bloopers. So that's one thing you get. Like you get a lot of these social media memes and stuff like that and little videos. And somebody that doesn't really know Bill will send you or I, this is one of Bill falling in the lake off the bank or whatever like that. Yeah. We know that one. You see this one? Yeah. So...
Anyways, I want to thank everybody for making this the wonderful show that it is. Our entire crew, Volva there behind the camera, Nikki absent in the seat, and Dean quiet.
Come on,
I can hear him breathe.
There he is. He's back. Dean's back.
Hell yeah.
Oh, is he back now? Look out.
And of course, my co-host, Peter Bowman. On behalf of all of those guys, I'm Angelo Viola. Thanks, folks. We'll talk to you soon.